Music tends to be one of the first things to get cut when school budgets dry up, but Nina Kraus says we should think twice about that move. Kraus studies the link between music and the brain. And it turns out musicians are better able to process auditory information, and they're also better readers. All thanks to what music does to our malleable brains. She's with us now to talk more about that connection. Welcome to Front and Center, Dr. Kraus.
Thank you.
Tell us about the Auditory Neuroscience Lab. For those of us who aren't scientists, how would you describe what it is you study?
Well, we're interested in how it is that experience affects how we process sounds. And we're constantly updating our brains with new information as we engage in our auditory world. And so we are really working on trying to understand the biological basis of auditory learning.
Your research is uncovering some fascinating new stuff about just how important musical training is in changing the brain and making it more receptive to literacy skills, right?
Yeah, it really would appear that playing a musical instrument has an impact on not only reading abilities, but basic auditory skills, such as being able to hear sounds in challenging situations. More broadly, it would appear that playing a musical instrument helps make us better learners.
And why would that be? What's going on in the brain?
As a musician, you're always picking out details from sounds in a complex soundscape. So, for example, when you're playing music, you're needing to pick out the sound of your own instrument or a harmony or melody line. You need to be able to determine whether a sound is coming from a string that is plucked or bowed. And it turns out that these listening skills transfer to everyday listening tasks that don't necessarily involve music. So, for example, listening to your friend's voice in a noisy restaurant or hearing a teacher's voice in a noisy classroom, that requires one to pick out the salient aspects of a sound in a complex background. And it turns out that musicians are better at doing this. So, for example, if you play people taped sentences and you ask them to repeat back what they heard, as you make the background noise level louder and louder, people who have musical training are better able to hear and to repeat back more accurately the speech that they heard.
And this is interesting because you can imagine a child in a classroom that their chair's scraping, there might be announcements coming over the PA system, there might be a low hubbub of voices. And the child who can pick out and process, you know, the information that the teacher is giving out amidst all that is going to have an advantage. And you sent us some sound files, and one is a voice using the sentence, "Sugar is very sweet."
Sugar is very sweet.
Tell us about that study.
We simply had participants repeat back sentences that they heard, and the sentences were embedded in noisier and noisier backgrounds. And then we scored the performance of people who had musical experience or not, and found that the musicians were much better at being able to hear the speech and to repeat back the speech accurately, even when it was presented in a very challenging and noisy listening situation. A child in a classroom is just able to automatically pick up on the essential sounds that he or she needs to listen to. And so we're really interested in the biology of this. So how is it that the nervous system processes sound? And secondly, how does the experience of having played a musical instrument alter the way that the nervous system automatically processes all kinds of sounds, not only musical sounds?
So in terms of a child who's a musician who studied music, how is it that their brain seems to be more efficient at processing the barrage of auditory input that comes at us?
Well, the way we'd look at it is, of course, as I'm talking to you now, the nerves in your brain that respond to sound are giving off electricity. And we can capture those electrical events with scalp electrodes. And so we play sounds to our participants, and then we pick up the electrical activity that happens in response to those sounds. any speech or musical sounds consist of elements, their timing, how fast they occur, their pitch, how high or low they are, their harmonics, how rich in timbre. The harmonics are what distinguish the sound of two different instruments, say a flute and a tuba playing the same note. The harmonics are different. And harmonics are really also what help us distinguish speech sounds. So gas and das and bas are distinguished by these timing and harmonic cues. And so given that all of this rich information is present in the sound wave, when we capture the response of the nervous system to that sound wave, we can see how it is that the very specific elements of sound have been transcribed by the nervous system. If you actually physically look at a representation of a sound wave and then you physically look at a representation of the brain wave, you'll see that they resemble each other. And you can actually, in the same way as you play a sound wave through a speaker, you can play the electrical activity that we've gotten from the brain, you can play that back. It has a very strong resemblance to the sound, to the stimulus that was used to excite the nervous system in the first place.
And you sent us the sound file of what you're talking about now. It's kind of amazing to listen to. First, you have the sound of the scale being played on a keyboard, and then the second clip that we hear is the sound of the brain kind of playing it back, right?
That's exactly right. So you can do that with speech sounds, like the syllable da, spoken higher and low, lower, like da,
da
and da.
Da.
There's a clip of Deep Purple playing Smoke on the Water. We find that when we analyze the responses that we obtain from people who have had musical experience, that these elements of timing, especially in the information-rich aspects of the sound, you know, so the part of a syllable that really makes a da distinct from a ba, those are these elements that the nervous system of a person with musical training is able to automatically extract.
Now, can you tie that into reading for us? I can see how that would be especially useful if you were extracting auditory information from a hubbub of noise, but how does that translate into better readers?
Well, in order to learn to read, we need to be able to associate a sound with a letter. And that association between the auditory information and the visual information on a page is very important, and there has been a tremendous amount of research over the years indicating that the ability to read, in most cases, is very strongly tied to people's ability to perceive sounds and to process sounds. In addition, in the same way as it is important to remember what it is that you have just heard, you have to remember what it is that you've just read. And so you can imagine how exercising your working memory would have implications not only for carrying on a conversation, but also for reading.
Because you need to track where you are in the conversation.
Yeah, and you have to remember, you know, that you call it working memory because you're really working in the moment. You're holding in your mind the information that you have just received. So whether you have just read that information or whether you're listening to a conversation, you're holding that information in your mind so that you can think about it and process it and move on.
This is Front and Center, coming to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking with Nina Kraus. She's a neuroscientist at Northwestern University in Chicago who studies the way music primes the brain for reading and language. We're talking about how music may be a much bigger package to the learner, to the learning brain, than we've thought. And I guess the question would be then, should we be parceling music education with literacy programs.
I really do believe that music education should be part of the fundamental educational curriculum, and it should be fundamental to the educational process.
Aren't you working with some schools in Chicago, for instance, trying to see at one point musical education kicks in and really amps up literacy skills?
Yes. In fact, we have two. One involves a number of Chicago's public schools, and another involves public schools in L.A. And in both of these settings, these are kids who have never had access to musical instruction, but through the programs that these schools have developed, they now are able to receive musical instruction on a regular basis in the Chicago Public Schools. And these are longitudinal studies, so the Chicago project is over the 4 years of high school, so we track incoming freshmen through their senior year, provided they stay in school. And it would appear that outcomes for kids staying in school are better if they are engaged in musical programs. So we're not only looking at how they are doing perceptually, educationally, how they perform on various measures of reading, of hearing in noise. We are looking at their attention. You know, the biology is entirely objective, and it just doesn't matter whether the student wants to pay attention to the sound or not. The nervous system is going to respond to the sounds that we play them automatically, just based on the experience that that child has had with sound over their lives. And so if we are able to track these children and to be able to understand better how their nervous system may change as they are engaged in these programs, I think that that will help us understand some of the biological transformations and the biological bases for the musician advantage.
So according to what you just said, I mean, does that mean that all those Baby Einstein DVDs and CDs are actually paying off? That you have no choice but to respond to music that has...
No.
can't be that easy, huh?
No, because that's passive listening. I like to give the analogy is you're not going to get physically fit by watching spectator sports. So just listening to music does not involve all the things that I have been talking about in terms of, you know, for example, remembering the sounds and needing to hold it in your mind while you're trying to play the notes on a piano or a guitar. It does not engage your attention to particular aspects of the sound.
So you're really talking about engaging, learning, working inside and with the music, and not just, like you said, being passive.
Exactly.
Do we have any idea whether a younger brain is better able to engage with these musical benefits that you're talking about? For instance, if you're trying to help an adult become literate, are they going to pick it up better if they've never studied music as a 40-year-old, a 50-year-old, if they're working on music and language at the same time?
Yeah, so there is really need for empirical evidence that demonstrates the ways in which the nervous system maintains its flexibility and is able to change throughout life. I mean, we know that developmentally, the nervous system is much more malleable earlier in life. We know that the way learning occurs is somewhat different earlier in life than later. It's more implicit rather than explicit. But we also know that the nervous system continues to have an ability to change and to learn new things until the organism dies. So there is a certain flexibility always just inherent in, I mean, the nervous system is a moving target. It is constantly changing and being shaped and sculpted by experience throughout our lives. But of course, there really are times in life when the nervous system is particularly receptive to learning new things. So, you know, for example, in most of the work that we have done, you know, we will define our musicians as people who have begun their musical training before they were 9 years old or so. You know, we and others, you know, we try to control these things. But as I say, it's going to be very important to really be able to document physiologically, for example, what are the changes that occur in the nervous system, and how good are people at learning a musical instrument, for example, from scratch when they're 60 years old.
I can't wait to hear what happens. Well, you're a musician, right? You play some instruments.
Sort of. I do play some instruments, not particularly well, but with great joy.
Now, did you start learning them as your research came out, or did you already play them?
No, I played as a child. My mom was a musician, and so I kind of was playing under the piano while she played, and then started playing some piano myself, and then later on, I now play electric guitar and little drums, and I'm just...
You're a one-woman band.
Yeah, hardly.
Well, I love that you're taking it seriously, though. Is that the advice that you would give to parents to make sure that your kids grow up musical and playing an instrument?
Absolutely. I firmly believe that, and I believe it for my own family and my own three kids. They had to do well in school, play their instrument, and tell me where they were. And those are the rules.
In that order, huh? Well, Dr. Krauss, thank you so much for joining us on Front and Center.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a special broadcast of Front and Center. Tomorrow we'll travel to Michigan, where Jen White will host a one-hour show on low literacy and civic participation. We'll hear how citizenship can sometimes be out of reach for people who can't read. And we'll learn about the social implications of low literacy. All that and more on tomorrow's installment of Front and Center. Today's show was produced by Marika Suval and Rhonda Fanning with help from Tim Allen and Aubrey Ralph. Special thanks to WBEZ's Aurora Aguilar, Trisha Bobeda, Shannon Heffernan, Adam Yaffe, Sean O'Coin, and Tori Malatia. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this has been Front and Center.